This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Jane Ann Phillips, the author of a new book called Lark and Termite. Hi, Jane Ann, how are you?
Hi, David, I'm good.
It's really good to talk to you. This is a book that came out earlier this year, and I guess I want to talk a little bit about this book, but I also want to mention, I guess, to people who are listening that you and I have a connection that goes back quite a long ways to when I first published a book of yours called Sweethearts, which was a small book, but officially your first book, and later became
1976, and it was 24 one-page fiction. You were my first publisher at Truck Press.
I remember it. And in fact, it's a book that was later made part of what became your first real larger trade commercial book. But I always, I go back to Sweethearts periodically because I think that I still think the writing in that book is tremendous.
Yeah, and not all of it was in Black Tickets. I think about half of it was included, but not. I think there were 18, maybe 18 out of 24. Yeah.
Yeah, and with
so Sweethearts is still its own document in a way.
Well, it is a it holds together, I think, as a piece. I still have some, I have some original copies there. We did it in a very small first edition of about 400 copies. If you remember, it was in a very unusual size because we wanted to fit. I think we were trying then to make the book very much reflect the content. And interestingly, in that book, the photographic imagery was very important, which I know, I feel like that is true of your work throughout your life. The imagery and the photography that I've seen on your website, you've used old photographs. And in Lark and Termite, there are some images that are very important.
Yeah, small press publishing really, really spoiled me because I keep having this sense that publishers like Simon & Schuster and Random House should really listen to what I say about how the book should be designed. Which, of course, they don't like to do. But I was really happy with the design of Lark and Termite. I thought they did a wonderful job with, working in some of my research materials into the actual design of the book.
Well, and I guess I wanted to ask you about that. In the frontispiece of the book, there's a drawing, kind of mysterious drawing of a boy, it looks like. And it says, it's hard to read, but it says 414 the termite. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the acknowledgments, I actually thank the artist who did that drawing, Mary Sherman, who's gone on to have a career. But I don't know, maybe 20 years ago in Cambridge, I was invited to a birthday party. Her then boyfriend and I shared the same birthday, and she ripped that page out of her notebook, basically, and gave it to me because I admired it. And it immediately struck me as looking like that boy that I had seen in Buchanan, West Virginia, maybe 10 years before. And she had written across the top something about termite, and the rest of the writing is sort of illegible. But he became Termite for me because of that drawing. I sort of thought of him by that name long before the book itself was being written. So in the novel, of course, it is Lark's drawing of Termite because she, like Lola, is an amateur artist.
And we probably should say there are the two characters, Lark and Termite, are half-brother and half-sister.
Right, they have the same mother and different fathers, and Lark is around 17, and Termite is 9 in the 1959 parallel world of the book, whereas the other world takes place in the same 3 July days in Korea in 1950.
Right, so you move back and forth throughout the book between where the story takes place more fully, I think, in 1959. But the backdrop, or as you said, parallel story, is in Korea, where this soldier Levitt is, and his voice is really the voice from that period. He's the father of Termite.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's then the fourth voice is it Noni or Nani?
Noni.
Who's the mother? Who's the sister of? But she acts as the surrogate mother for both Lark and Termite. But it's her sister Lola who is the mother of both of these kids.
Right. And both of them have been left to her to raise at various times. And you know, Levitt from the beginning in 1950 is very aware that his child is about to be born in the States as he's engaged in trying to evacuate a group of Korean villages in the wake of the North Korean advance. So then in that first section, you have sort of the real world and the real chaos of the war, and telescoped into it is Levitt's life and his past and his knowledge of Lola and the fact that this child is about to be born. And that child, of course, turns out to be Termite.
Right, and Termite, as you cast him, is as they would say, disabled, and has severely limited physical abilities, and isn't able to talk in normal kind of language. But you've created a kind of internal world for him, so he becomes you inhabit his character as one of the voices,
right,
in the book. And I also, there is a connection, I think, spiritually or sort of emotionally through the book with another character where Levitt is in this tunnel, which, as I realized from reading some of the corollary stuff, was based on real-life events. But he's in a tunnel with a bunch of Korean refugees pinned down by American fire. And there's a woman who has another child, her child, who's both taking care of him as he's wounded, mortally wounded, and also trying to protect her son, who's on her back. And I felt really strongly, and I don't know whether you did this on purpose, that there was a connection between Termite and that boy.
Oh, yeah, it's sort of, there are parallel worlds kind of set up from the very beginning, and the girl, Levitt, is trapped in that situation because he's decided to wade into this crowd of refugees and help this girl who is trying to carry a child who can't walk. And Levitt doesn't know if it's her son or her brother or what, and he'd never, he does find out in the tunnel, but they run into a tunnel, a kind of double railroad tunnel, which of course is a fixture of the 1959 world as well. And he's trapped there, which did not actually happen as far as we know, but it certainly could have happened because that the world of the Korean War is based on the Nogun Ri incident, which was in fact revealed 50 years after it happened. It was a secret for 50 years. And the sort of backstory of the novel is that it's sort of been in my mind, like many of my books, for many, many years. And 30 years ago, I saw this child in my hometown. I was visiting a friend from high school, and she'd rented a little apartment over a kind of double garage in a residential area. And behind her apartment, there was a kind of beautiful southern grass alley, very green with sort of tire tracks up the middle, and there were a row of modest houses fronting on the alley, and in the yard of one of them sat this empty 1950s lawn chair. It wasn't empty because it was a boy sitting in it with his legs folded up under him, very much just the way I described Termite, and he was actually holding to his forehead this strip of a dry cleaning bag of blue. I don't think they make them blue anymore, but they did then. And he was just blowing on it and looking through it. And I said to my friend, "Who is that and what is he doing?" And she said, "I don't know, but he sits that way for hours." So it was almost as though I tried to answer that question many years later, who is he and what is he doing in the world that the book sort of built around him. But the first lines in the book were Lark's lines, I move his chair into the yard under the tree, and then Noni carries him out. And that world of the town was sort of defined for me in her voice, the fact that Termite doesn't speak, but he repeats the last few syllables of what is said to him. We never know if it's sort of by choice or because, you know, he can't say words.
But you give him a tremendous, I mean, I really think you kind of inhabit him and give him a world that he can...
Yeah, I mean, part of the fascination for me in this book was to try to write a character who doesn't speak in language and yet represent his perceptions in language. And I think we never know what people are really perceiving if they can't communicate.
Well, you never know what people are really thinking, even when they can communicate.
That might be even harder to tell. But,
right. No, but I think I thought that was very beautiful and striking. You know, and obviously the sort of mundane way of thinking about it is that you've made sure that the reader is able to overcome the initial perception of a person with. Who's not able to function in the full normal sense,
mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty striking. But of course, I thought you did that for other characters as well, and that you know with Lark, I think she's got a tremendous power and ability to to take control of her life. And so, you know, it's sort of I think the running theme in a lot of ways is, and I'm not sure you intended this or not, but that there are people who appear to be hindered by events or by circumstances, and they overcome.
Yeah, in that sense, it's an extremely hopeful book, because the strength of the characters seems to finally evolve into a kind of triumph, and this really has been building since the events that caused Levitt's death. It's almost as though, there is a connection between the Korean girl and that boy and these children, another, you know, a world away.
Right, well, I definitely felt
that. There
is
a connection between, you know, all of us, and that's part of the, you know, the connect inside the book. I mean, there's also... and again, it was not something I exactly planned. It sort of evolved in the writing of the book, but it's a book full of secrets. And each one of those secrets sort of comes to fruition or, you know, evolves into openness. But the reader, because he or she has access to the perceptions of all the characters and certain secrets, actually knows more through straight to the end of the book than the characters know about each other or about what really happened.
No, that's true. You give the reader a kind of narrative, the narrator's perspective. But I thought that, you know, and it was interesting because the story the development of the story, because you're in two different places throughout the book and the characters don't operate in a kind of strictly... traditional fictional way, and you know, with a and I thought that was I thought you were I know this is probably an overused word, but it was deft. I really thought that you handled that brilliantly, so that you know, there were times as I was reading and I was thinking, well, I'm not quite sure I understand where we're going, but then at the end everything did wrap up, and I had to think about why I had questioned where the story was going, because it was much clearer than I realized while I was reading. Maybe it was also partially, as you read this book, because your writing is, you know, especially the internalization of the characters, their own perceptions of things. I mean, it's really incredibly beautiful writing.
Thank you. Well, I really wanted to write a book that would be interesting and revelatory on a second read. You know, I think that when the first time you read it, you sort of get it. But the second time you read it, you see how everything is moving.
No, I think that's right. I felt that I had to go back. I haven't fully done that, but I did feel at the end I wanted to go back and reread to re-understand what I had only absorbed as on the first read, if you know what I mean. Sometimes when you read a story, you realize later how much more complexity there is. I mean, you can read it on the first level without a problem. You can just read it straight through, it's fine. But a second read is going to give me a whole lot more depth. And I think you did that. It's very difficult, you know, if you sort of imagine reading about a character. Characters, many of your characters are either dead or dying in the book, or as you said, they have these secrets. So you know, it's a challenge on one level to read about a story that is not an action story in the traditional sense. It requires a much more thoughtful reading.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk about the plot, sort of apart from the book, it sounds like it's packed with action, and in fact it is. I mean, so many different things happen, you know, a crime, a flood, a war. But, you know, I think the lifespan of any human being is really so brief. It's kind of blink of an eye country, and I think when we read a book, we want to have a sense of the long sweep of history and that sort of adjacent dimension of connection between one life and another that really isn't bordered by death. I mean, the idea that Levitt continues is really a strong sense in the book, and the idea that the sort of intersecting circles of these lives is its own kind of eternity is something that I really wanted the reader to take away, which is also, in a sense, a hopeful idea, you know, the idea that death is not necessarily the end. I mean, it's the end of a certain physical manifestation, you might say, but it's not necessarily all there is.
Right, and maybe that's something as we get older, we kind of realize how brief time is, because you know, you can look at a span of time. You and I both grew up in the 50s, and I thought you evoked that period really well. And I remember when I was a kid inhabiting that world, you know, where the Korean War was recent, and the, things were, the sort of simplicity of some of the political and social world. You realize that time, that wasn't that long ago. I mean, we're talking about, for us, it's 40 years ago. It's not that long.
Yeah, I think the poet, the writer's sensibility is always fixed on death, in a sense. Not as a grim sort of thing, but as a way of setting life into a kind of sharp relief. So that's why things appear so sensual and... It's a kind of enriching point of view, in a sense. I mean, I don't actually remember the 50s at all. I mean, I was born in 52, so I was like a young child. I think I came to consciousness around the time that Ike Eisenhower seemed to have always been president, you know. I do remember that.
Yeah,
but I don't remember anything whatsoever about the Korean War. My father was a World War II veteran, and it just didn't kind of enter my consciousness. And it sort of is the forgotten war in America, but for me it was a very rich, sort of a rich world, partly because it was such a precursor to Vietnam, even though no one noticed. I mean, it was a military action, it was a UN action, it was a civil war, it dragged on. The only difference really between... Well, not the only difference, but the primary difference between Korea and Vietnam was that something actually came of it. I mean, South Korea is still an independent country, and the alternative would have been North Korea, which, you know, we see as one of the most repressive regimes on Earth. So it's not the same as, you know, pulling a country that probably should have been communist, given its state of, the state of its economy and everything else, kind of recovering from colonialism. It wasn't at all the same kind of battle. So I think Korea is very interesting too, from that standpoint.
Yeah, I think it is, and it is probably a kind of an era or a period that is not often written about, especially today. But I thought that this you did an amazing piece of work here, and it's just a beautiful novel, and I hope that it will be recognized as a really terrific piece of work.
Well, I hope so too. One never knows.
This is true. Now, before we end, I know this book took a long time for you to write. It was at least 9 years between this book and the book before it. Are you working on something new now?
I am, and I have a sort of big life, as Grace Paley would say, in that I run a very interesting new MFA program at Rutgers Newark, and I've been engaged in that for the past like 5 years, and it does take me a long time to write my work just in general, but I think working at sort of three jobs in a sense, parenting, teaching, administrating, the writing kind of gets done in between, and I'm hoping that this next book will go a little faster. But I'm very much engaged in that next book.
Well, I will be anxious to read it, and I hope that we can keep in touch about that. I'm planning on doing another channel on Writer's Cast where I'll have writers dial in to record reading some of their work, and I'm hoping that maybe I can invite you to be part of that.
Okay, yeah, sure, David.
Well, thanks, Jane Ann. I really appreciate talking to you. This is David Wilk. I've been talking to Jane Ann Phillips, whose newest book is Lark and Termite, and whose first book was called Sweethearts. This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Bye.